club isn't the best place to find a lover, so the lab is where I go. So my girlfriend and I mopping blood till it's dry, picking fingers up as we go. Come on over and start up a conversation with just me, and trust me, I'll give you some eggs. We will listen to tunes and learn sign language soon, and if I like you, then I'll help you escape. Boy, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for somebody like me. Come on, swim over to me. Come on, swim over to me. Boy, you don't talk too much. That doesn't matter for somebody like me. Come on, swim over to me. Come on, swim over to me. It's the shape of OH2. Lose my job for a fish like you. We're being chased by Strickland too. I'm in love with the water. Last night you were in my tub. Yes, it's weird, but I guess it's love. Every time we touch, your skin turns blue. I'm in love with the water.
Oh, why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why?
I'm in love with the water.
Oh, why, oh, why, oh, why, oh, why?
I'm in love with the water.
Oh, man, let no one ever say we don't take risks, all right? Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish.
Welcome to the podcast. I am so excited this week to be talking about The Shape of Water, the new film by Guillermo del Toro. I'm sure I messed up his name there, but that's okay. I'm sure he won't mind. Shape of Water tells the story of Eliza, a mute servant in a medical facility, or at least a scientific facility. She and her crew are run cleanup in the underground facility of a scientific lab, where she soon discovers a creature that has been brought in, unlike anything she has ever met before. And out of that chance meeting, a relationship blossoms between her and the quote-unquote monster. But who is the monster, really? It stars Michael Shannon, Doug Jones, and Sally Hawkins, and, of course, Octavia Spencer as well. And we're excited to talk about it this week. And we are also thrilled to have back the monster to my mash, Ben Dower, and the Dell to my Toro, Andrew Eaton. Welcome back, guys. So glad you're here. But before we get into this, I should say that this will be filled with spoilers. So if you want to watch the film first, just so you're aware, we are going to talk about the film openly with all sorts of plot details. So if that's an issue for you and you want to see the film first, you feel free to do that. Otherwise, let's dive in. What did you guys think of Shape of Water?
No, I enjoyed it. It was good. It was a fun little movie.
What was it you liked?
It had a monster.
So the bar is low, is what you're saying.
That's a high bar to meet, a monster.
That's true. Not every movie has a monster.
Not every movie has a monster. In fact, I'd argue most of them don't.
You'd also argue the latest Godzilla movie didn't have a monster as well, but that's another story.
The second to last one.
Yeah. That's fair.
Didn't have much of the monster.
Because in the end, the monster is in all of us?
Oh.
That's a good way to end the podcast. We'll remember that.
We're a little bit off topic.
Andrew, what did you think?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a powerful, original story. Colors were gorgeous.
The teal?
The teal.
Teal, yes.
The teal.
It was neat, because it was... I didn't realize how many different shades of teal you could get into one movie, and we seem to have found them.
Instead of calling it The Shape of Water, they should have called it The Shades of Teal.
50 Shades of Teal? That would almost be an accurate title for this film.
On multiple levels.
On multiple levels.
Wow.
There's your Taylor Swift song. There it is, right there. There it is.
Yeah.
Taylor and Zane doing the theme song for The Shape of Water. Yeah, it was, honestly, it was a beautiful movie. I can't say that I loved it, but I also can't say I wasn't drawn in. It was like casting a spell on you in a weird way. So lyrical, it sort of ebbed and flowed. I hate to use the frame of reference of, you know, like a river or like water, but it did have that feel. And not just because there is a ridiculous amount of water in that movie, The storytelling, which is so stylized, just the way the characters move, the camera moves, it just sort of drew you in, the fantasy element. It was really something to see. But more than that, it had a story to tell. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the other thing. There's lots of movies you can say, wow, it was really beautiful, but it was empty. Mm-hmm. Was Del Toro the one that did Pacific Rim?
Yes.
Yeah, see, that was beautiful and empty. I think that's an example of a movie I just found empty.
But it had monsters in it.
It did have monsters in it, Ben. We're going to keep coming back to this. Because in the end, the monster is in all of us. And that's... But I will say this, and I'm not sure if I'm going to... whether this will make it in the final cut or not, but when he made Pacific Rim, he said he wanted to make a film about smashing monsters together in a bathtub. He kind of did the same thing here, in some ways. But it was weird. It was weird. And I, like, having gone to, obviously, go to the film's theaters all the time, but there were applause, like, not rapturous applause, but the whole theater was clapping at the end of this film. And I think you guys were saying that happened when you guys saw it as well.
Yeah, it did. But oddly, not me. Just like everybody broke into applause, and my sister who went with me and I are just sitting there sort of looking around, and everybody's clapping. We're like, what happened? I mean, this never happens. And like, we didn't join in. Like, what was this thing that moved everybody to applause except us?
And you were moved, and you missed it. Missed out on it.
I missed whatever this was that made everybody clap. I mean... It was weird. It was just weird that we missed it too. But
well, it was amazing. It's interesting. It played at TIFF. It did not win. I thought it was going to win People's Choice because every show was sold out. Hmm. Every single show. And were you in the lineup when we were you?
No,
with
I didn't. Line
you didn't line up for the
friend did though.
Because I lined up for 2 hours for it on the last day of the fest or something like that, and still didn't get it in the Elgin, which is a 2,000-person theater, and there, I think they said the rush line, only 20 people showed up, which means 2,000 people bought their tickets and 2,000 people showed up. It's just, it's madness. It's madness. Now, I see that it's a beautiful film, but it really is sort of sweeping people off their feet. It's really interesting.
And yet it was only at, like, a few theaters here.
I think it's going to go wide, though.
You think it is going to go wide? Okay.
Yeah, this is the time of year where you'll drop the big one, and it'll drop the big name film, and then it'll go wide in the end of December, early January. They have to get the Oscar qualifying run in now. And this has already won the Best Director for the New York Film Critics Association, I believe. There may be other nominations it's gotten from these other awards, and there's been lots of buzz about this film. Mm-hmm. I know somebody that said it was the best film they ever saw, and they saw it 5 times.
Wow. Oh, really?
Yeah. And this was, I mean, it was at TIFF for, sorry, it wasn't 5 times. They saw it 3 times, all at TIFF.
Wow.
They kept going.
All 3 showings, probably.
All 3 showings.
Yeah.
I mean, there is something lyrical about it. There's something beautiful about the film, I suppose.
There's also an endearing aspect to its main inspiration. So the main character, Eliza Doolittle, that's the same name as the character in Pygmalion. Which is George Bernard Shaw's play.
I never made that connection. Her last name in the film isn't Doolittle. You
isn't
know that?
It though?
No, it's. I have it right here. It is Eliza Esposito.
Oh, okay.
But the Eliza Doolittle comparison is totally apt. I had never thought of that.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah,
and especially with My Fair Lady, Pygmalion's film adaptation and their homage to black and white musicals.
Yeah, that's so true. See, I just took those as. A reminder of classic stories. Mm. It sort of brought you into this world of fantasy classic storytelling. Mm. You know, it was built, structured like a fairy tale. But that's interesting because this film almost becomes the reverse of that, whereas Eliza Doolittle is brought along to become the, I guess she's believe, or the wealthy men bet on whether or not they can make her a lady. Is that what it is? The Dr. Doolittle? Not Dr. Doolittle.
Isn't it that she's
that's a different story.
Isn't it that she's a sculptor who falls in love with one of her sculptures and then it comes to life?
Isn't it he is a sculptor?
In My Fair Lady?
I think it's a man, and, yeah, he makes a sculpture. He falls in love. Yeah, and brings his love. That's the original.
He doesn't bring her to the original. In Pygmalion?
Yeah, in the original.
Oh, not in My Fair Lady. No, My Fair Lady is not that. I'm like, what movie have you watched? Audrey Hepburn was not some statue that like today's special in the middle of the night.
Based on.
Yeah, the original play.
Oh, I was going to say, it's like the movie Mannequin in the 80s. It's like, only he can see her. Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize a Pygmalion was like that. Oh, okay.
Yeah. The original. Yeah.
That's interesting because the inverse of this is that, of course, he's the monster and she is, I don't know if civilizing him is the word, but taming the beast, if you will, bringing beauty to the beast,
giving him eggs.
Not many people know this, but that's how Ben met his wife. She brought him an egg, put it on the counter. He screamed at her and took the egg. It was a beautiful story. We were all very moved by it. But
nice. It's also incredibly untrue.
I'm glad you finally defended yourself. It was like... He just sat there in silence, and it was like, well, Steve's telling my story. Barely even friends. No. You know, we were talking before, and I think the performances in the film are pretty remarkable as well. Michael Shannon has this way of being ominous in everything that he's in. Although, did you see Midnight Special?
No.
He's like, he's ominous at the beginning, but he's this... He's almost lovable by the end of the film, which is a very different role for Michael Shannon in a lot of ways. But I thought he and Michael Stuhlbarg, is that how you pronounce it, just were incredible in this particular film. And you know what? Sally Hawkins had almost no lines at all in the film, but she was wonderful. She communicated a lot, which is a hard role to play because it's all in her face and her facial expressions and whatnot. I thought the performances were pretty incredible. One of the things that I wanted to talk about with you guys, there was a line when she opens it. The interesting, or her life is one of routine, as we see at the beginning of the film. She has a bath, has three eggs, boils water, and, you know, does the same routine every single day. And as she pulls off the calendar from the wall, there are these quotes at the back each day. And I believe the first quote is, "Time is a river flowing from our past." What do you think that means in the context of the film? What is it about this film that feels so relevant today, even though it takes place in 1962, which I think I only gather that because of the license plate on the car that Michael Shannon buys and is later destroyed in the most wonderful moment of the film in some ways.
That was pretty funny.
That was great. Really, the lights come on, he's like, it's so good.
After you made that big deal out of choosing it, right? And everybody's, oh, great car, sir. Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, there's something about it that makes it very relevant today.
The line, whatever you said, about water and past and all that. Within the context of the film, we can talk about, like, Eliza's past. She clearly had a bad past, though it's not hugely detailed, you know. She's had some sort of abuse as a child that ripped her voice box out. I think they mentioned that specifically. Mm-hmm. And
they don't say what it is, but
no,
they do.
They do mention
that it made her mute.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And something about an orphanage. But I think in a wider context, the film clearly has some sort of civil rights themes.
Mm.
And, you know, what is the line exactly here? Time is a river flowing from our past?
Time is but a river flowing from our past, yes.
Yeah, I think you could even apply that in terms of the civil rights themes. Where we're at now is from the turbulence of that time and the civil rights movement that was just getting started at the time the film's set.
Mm.
And I think you could apply it to that, to where we are now, especially with the current situation in the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting that, I think we're at a time now where we're starting to see the films pour out that are birthed out of the Trump era.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think people, I'm not even kidding when I heard this. When Lego Batman came out, people were saying it's a Trump film and all these, all those films were started years ago.
Yeah.
But now we're getting into the films that are truly out of the Trump era. I saw the Post this week. I'm going to podcast on that in January.
Right,
but,
which in any other time would just be boring old Spielberg with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep.
Yeah, but there's an urgency to it,
mm-hmm.
Which I think actually that film went into production about a month after he got elected,
right.
To be honest. You know, so here we now this film would not have been made 6 months ago because there's too much at stake. And shout out to Toronto. Did any of you... like
yes, yeah, the road it? Signs.
The road signs, or that theater is the Elgin.
Right.
It's the Elgin.
Yeah, with about as many people in it.
Yeah. Except when they're showing Shape of Water, apparently, because I got left out. But yeah, it is interesting that we're at this point now where the films are actually being created in the Trump era,
yeah.
As opposed to just starting. You know,
right.
Because he's been been almost a year.
I mean, any time before. In the last decade, if you made like a film with, you know, anti-racism and civil rights themes, you'd say, oh, that's a good movie, push
sure.
A good message. Now there's more of a, you know, but there was a sense in some way, like, you know, we've kind of gotten past that now, we're better, we're improving,
hmm.
But now we know we aren't as a society.
Hmm.
Where we should be. Like, it's really clear to everybody.
Yeah.
We're not as far along as we thought.
I think Del Toro was very intentional about giving that kind of permissiveness to a spectrum of race and sexualities. I mean...
yeah, oh, it was broad.
Fishman.
Yeah.
Well, Fishman, but also... Richard Jenkins' character is gay.
Right.
He's in love with the cashier or whatever he is, the guy at the diner.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. It's just the fish man and the mute woman.
Yeah. Which the characters around them sort of accept unquestionably.
Yeah.
That's true. That's interesting. All the people that accept it are the ones that are marginalized.
Yes.
Which is interesting. I hadn't thought of that until now.
Hmm.
But when Michael Shannon buys the car, when Strickland buys the car... the guy says to him, this car is from the future, and you seem like a man who's from the future.
A classic, like, early 1960s Cold War thing to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This here's the future, and you strike me as a man that's from there. That's what he says.
Yeah.
But he's the one that seems the most out of place within the film.
Well, he's sort of the most out of date. He's someone with that very much, you know, World War II military personality. The world is shifting.
Yeah.
It's moving away from people like Strickland.
Yeah.
Yeah, even the
Russians. He's racist. He's outright racist.
Yeah.
The black woman. Like, he's not from the future.
Yeah.
He has a line. What does he say? Human Zelda. He looks human. Like you. Or even me.
That's
probably more like me.
That's it. Yeah.
That's what he says.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting how out of place he feels.
He seems,
but that's the clear difference in a film made in 2017, looking back at the 60s, than a film made in the 60s, right? Which would have just brought all these things in. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Although you could argue that was changing then too,
right?
In film and stories, I thought it was really interesting. One of the things, of course, he loses his fingers, but his fingers get increasingly darker as the film goes on. And at one point, his guy looks at him and says, you're black,
mm-hmm.
and he's clearly dissatisfied with himself, to the point where it actually breaks them off and it hurts him, but he does it, and he does it in the home of, he does it in Zelda's home, which is interesting. He does it in Zelda's home and throws it at the TV.
That's right.
I think that to me is one of the most interesting parts, is the fact that I'd never considered until this moment that he is the one that seems out of place within the film. But I think I was saying with you guys before, in some ways that reminded me of District 9, because in District 9 you have Charlton Copley, I think that's his name, how he becomes more and more increasingly like the aliens, and he sort of takes on the role of one. He, as the more he becomes one, the more he understands what life is like one. But in his case, in Strickland's case, he breaks off his fingers and throws them away because he can't accept that parts of him are different than they were before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also because his fingers are broken. Yeah, yeah. But that's not... it's more than that, though, because they indicate it, right?
Yeah. There's also the scene in the diner where the black couple comes in.
Yes.
Yeah, he's like, you can take out, but you can't sit down.
Right.
The other guy, I can't remember his name. The guy that lives with Sally.
That was Richard Jenkins. That's Giles. Right. Yeah. Giles. Giles.
He's sort of like, you know, you don't need to do that, right? Like, he kind of tells him off.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
And then he gets kicked out,
yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because in that moment, what you see is, the culture and them is split in two, sort of there. Yeah. You see that this is just sort of the acceptable behavior, but it's also not. The film is very clear that that's not.
Yeah, isn't that what motivates him to help Sally?
He also gets fired, because he says, I have nobody.
That's right.
It's interesting how he...
That's the one that does, yeah.
That was the kicker, because... He gets fired, and then he goes...
He goes to the diner, right?
He goes to the diner after that.
And then he goes back.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, so he sort of, yeah. Yeah.
There is a clear thread throughout Del Toro's films of people of the kind of lowliest class and stature being the purest of heart, or the main protagonist, whereas the people in positions of power and influence are often corrupted and evil and that kind of thing, and that stays true throughout this one.
Yeah. I'm not as familiar with Del Toro's work. I think this may have been the first one I've seen all the way through, to be honest with you. I haven't seen Crimson Peak.
Pacific Rim?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Pacific Rim. This is my first good movie seeing from Del Toro. Can't count that.
It's got monsters.
It's got monsters. Because in the end,
that's all
the monster is in all of us. And that's, I'm going to keep saying it until it's funny. And and I think you're right. I think politically we're at a time right now where these films seem even more poignant. Mm-hmm. You know, this river to the past that we were talking about.
Well, we don't seem to have progressed any since then.
It seems not.
As much as, you know, we like to think we have, mm-hmm. we haven't at all. It seems. At least, like, everything's rolling back in the United States.
If this film had been made 20 years ago, do you think it would be as diverse as it is?
Probably not. No. You probably wouldn't have seen such an open acceptance of sexuality if it was.
Yeah, that's what would have been different.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
So that's what the film is about. It's about a woman's right to marry a monster if she so chooses.
Well, a lot of it is about a woman's sexual independence.
That's true.
So it is not very often you see a woman masturbating in a film.
Nope.
It's not very often you see anybody really masturbating in a film, but especially not a woman.
Well, especially
right,
not a
yeah.
woman.
And the percentage of those moments within film, yes, yeah. You're right. It's... That's
and
true.
Such a way that's clearly just for her own pleasure as part of her daily routine and not as an object of desire for the audience.
That's true, because there's really no indication. She just get or really no specific focus. It's just for her to. It's just for her own pleasure in her moment, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. You talk about that, or when you talk about we talk about masturbating as sort of female sexual empowerment, but there seemed to be this sort of theme of almost awakening within the film and actually love being a motivator behind it. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what you guys thought about that and how it played into the film. Hmm. Ben has not thought of that.
I have not. I'm still on the monster. There's a monster in this movie.
I think the monster is important to that, though, because I think the monster is the motivation behind that. The monster, after anybody comes in contact with a monster, sort of sees the world differently.
So while
are you laughing because she has sex with the monster a lot, aren't you?
While we have
she came into contact with the monster a lot, so yeah, that's what's happening.
While we haven't seen a Cold War film of a woman falling in love with a fish man, we have seen Cold War films of
but a man falling in love with a fish woman.
Is that a fish called Wanda?
Yeah. Little Mermaid.
All right.
Actually, listen.
Yeah. No, but there's a lot of Cold War films about, you know, an American captured in Russia and a Russian woman falls in love with them and rescues them and that sort of thing. Everyone human. So this is sort of that, but with the Fishlands. And I think that love in that instance comes out of seeing someone persecuted and struggling, and you make a human connection with them. In this case, it's a fish connection.
I don't know if this is really on the topic or not, but like what you're saying, there's one thing to say, you know, those people over there are less than me. But when you have a personal connection, you can realize, no, they're the same as me, you know? It's easy to demonize what you don't know.
Right, and the lab staff worked to dehumanize the monster by calling it an asset.
An asset, yeah, they used all those words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even...
She fed it, she treated it like a living creature.
Yeah.
Which then allowed a connection to form.
And even in her conversation about it with Gilles, he's like, wait, are you saying them, it, him? They talk about, like, the use of pronouns and how they refer to it.
And something about, you know, it's not intelligent, it can't speak or something. She's like, I can't speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I can communicate the same as it.
Yes, that's right. What makes me so different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is some... I think I might actually be landing where I was joking before. There is something universal about monsters or aliens. You know, I think we saw this, talk about the Cold War. In the early 90s, until the early 90s, what was every villain? Every villain was Russia in every film.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the 90s, around 92, I think it was 92, was, but there, I think that year, that was when the alien movies started flooding out because the Cold War was over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the Russians were not the quote-unquote enemy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nowadays, even now when you take a country, like the Russians were quite humanized.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just big bad Russia, because the big bad U.S., big bad Russia, everyone was bad.
Yeah.
But the monster becomes a universal person that we're sort of drawn into, you know? Like, the aliens are the every villain, you know?
Yeah. Well, like you said about the Cold War and the Russians, I can remember, back to my favorite, Godzilla, in the Return of Godzilla Japanese version, there's Russians, and it's a Cold War, tensions are really high. And the Japanese version has the Russians as there. They're a cog in the world affairs.
Mm.
When the film came out in the United States, there was a slight edit to make them the villains.
Hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
When there's a guy who's trying to stop a nuclear bomb from going off and he gets killed by Godzilla along the way. The American edit actually did a shot of his finger going up to press the button to launch the bomb.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because it was that time, right? So like you said, the Russians were the bad guys. Even when there was a monster, the Russians were the bad guys.
There always seems to be a villain,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is portrayed culturally a villain.
Culturally,
and when you come to a place, you come to a culture which is trying to humanize everyone, proper and rightly so.
Yeah.
You need... something common to, like, who is the villain when everybody's got the same problems,
mm-hmm.
when everybody's broken and everybody is to be loved, who's the bad guy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing about this particular beast, is that it really is everybody in some way or another can relate to this creature, because they make this creature, even though he looks like the creature from the Black Lagoon, almost they make him as human as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a key in the film, and a key to human rights and civil rights, is empathy, right? If you don't have empathy for something, you're not going to care for it.
Yeah.
But when you watch this movie, you have empathy for the monster, you have it for Sally's character, for Richard, for even the black couple that comes in the diner.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
For Zelda as well.
And for Zelda, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Empathy is a strong, strong theme.
But you don't have it for Strickland.
No, I honestly thought they were trying to build that at one point, because Strickland
has
his family.
I was like, oh, no, they're humanizing. Even that was in my head. They're humanizing, because I know, like, for writing, if you want to keep someone a villain, you don't create empathy. And when you give someone a family and a background and a deeper motivation, you humanize them.
Right.
You know, and talking about sex as well, since, you know, Ben was just talking about sex. No, he wasn't,
yes.
But yeah.
That's exactly what I was talking about.
But you know what, I mean, think there is a lot of sex in this movie, there is. But it is different
and it's shown differently.
Hmm. Yes.
You know, we talk about Sally Hawkins, or we talk about Eliza masturbating in the bathtub. All you see is the look on her face mm-hmm. and whatnot. There is nudity from her character, but even the way that she moves and the way that they portray it, it's almost a thing of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a beauty angle as opposed to...
Yeah, it felt more like, just throw this out there, like one of those Greek statues or something. It wasn't
Yes.
It's not a sexualized object of desire. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is.
Hmm.
It is. I would say it is sexual. I think it's sexualized, but there's a beauty in the sexualization of it because she's quite a sexual character in this film. Like, she's not just, you know, this. It's not like she got lucky with the guy or,
right.
you know, hey, look, you know, it was like, there was some, again, there was intention behind the use of it. Like, you're so, and she's a beautiful woman, but she's not, you know, a supermodel.
Right.
So even the way that she is, the way that she's portrayed, though, is almost beautiful. But going back to Strickland, his wife, their sexual act is animalistic.
Mm-hmm.
Even the fact that, you know, as she's starting to unbutton her blouse, she whips her breast out.
Right.
Like, to the point that it was almost like, put it back, put it back. It was like, what's going on? And he just sort of grabs it. He almost, you know, strangles her. Not strangles her. Smothers her during sex.
Yeah.
You see them having sex.
Mm-hmm.
You never see Eliza and the Beast having sex. You see them slowly get in the room together. You see her naked. You see them embracing each other. There's no embrace with Strickland and his wife. It is just straight up lie down,
and
shut up.
And they still
up.
Mostly have most of their clothes on.
That's true. That's true, yeah.
Whereas Eliza gets completely naked and the fisherman stays the same.
Well, he glows.
He glows. There you go. He glows.
You would even say he glows.
Yeah.
Oh, man. There's so many jokes to this movie. I'm sorry. But no, he glows blue, which is almost for him. That's his nakedness because nobody else gets to see it but her.
That's true.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how sex plays a role and how it's portrayed as both beautiful and monstrous sort of at the same time.
Yeah.
His wife is literally like June Cleaver. You know, she comes in her pretty dress and she initiates. She says, oh, you're home. Meet me upstairs. What? It was unbelievable. It was really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I was really intrigued by, and going back, we got way far from Awakening, which is fine. I've enjoyed our conversation there. This idea that everybody the monster came into contact with in any way, shape, or form, there seemed to be this eye opening to them to see the world differently.
Mm.
Even the fact that, you know, when he scratches Giles' character, it actually heals his hair. Like, there's a healing that takes place from this. You know, the only one that isn't impacted by the monster is Strickland.
Mm. And the general.
Which general? Oh, the general, does he ever come in? I guess he does come into contact with him, but never really, never. He just sort of sees him and then leaves, right?
That's true.
You know, like, there was something about the way they created this beast. And they refer to him as a god. There was really interesting conversation about him as a god in this particular film. I think you mentioned that last night.
Well, it stood out to me because you don't see that a lot in American films. Or Western films, even.
That's more of an Eastern film thing?
More of a, like, Godzilla's always, even from the original film, a god.
Well, it's in his name.
No, it's in his name. Well, in the English, but
Well, I guess not. Gojira wouldn't be. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. But, I mean, at the beginning of the original series, he's worshipped on this island as a god. And there's mention of an old sacrifice they used to do to keep him at bay that sort of has faded out of fashion now.
Mm.
They don't do it anymore. And as much as he's scientific and physical, he is supernatural as well. And this is something you get, you don't get in the Western films. Like, Kong is worshipped as a god, but he's just an oversized gorilla.
That's true.
And that's how they initially spin this, is the fish man is worshipped as a god in South America, but he's not actually.
He's not. That's the thing, yeah. But then they pull the reversal at the end.
Yeah. Where,
oh, he is.
Yeah, that was actually... Yeah, well, he just goes... Well, he doesn't say, oh, crap, but... I won't, but... He says, crap. You are... He says,
like, you are a god.
Does he say you, or does he say he? He says...
You've got the whole script there.
I wrote it. Yeah, okay. He says, you are a god. Okay. No, I don't have the whole script. Okay. I was just making notes. Hmm. Anytime I hear it,
yeah.
An interesting thing I write down. Yeah, he says, you are a god.
Yeah. Now, the only other movies that come to mind off the top of my head where we've seen in the West monsters as gods, like as actual gods, that I've seen anyway, would be Pacific Rim, which is another Del Toro.
Based the monsters aren't seen as gods then, though, are they?
Yeah. Oh, they're definitely gods.
In what way?
They're coming from another dimension. They're powerful. They're there to destroy. There's like a sense of them being greater than us.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yes, okay.
They're like a god, yeah.
Like a, almost like Greek mythology type
like
gods.
Greek mythology, yeah.
The
they're like
the pantheon of gods.
They're like, yeah. They're not like all gods right. In the Western sense. Again, they're like just great beasts.
And they weren't created by man.
And they weren't
created. That's the other thing. Like,
yeah.
You know, yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah. They're more than just animals.
Right. Yeah.
And the other one would be Godzilla 2014.
In Japan?
No.
The American
yeah.
one?
Yeah. The American
yes,
2014
because
one with Sally Hawkins.
You're right. She was in that. I didn't even make that connection.
Hmm. Yeah. No, a god.
She refers to him as that in that film?
I think
film?
She calls him a god in that film, yeah.
Wow, okay. I did. Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Sure.
So those are the two, yeah. But in American films, yeah, they're typically can all be reduced to an animal worshipped as a god, or, you know, that's a typical
sense.
Because the 98 Godzilla did the same thing. It's just an oversized iguana. There's no reference to him being worshipped, no reference to him as a god. You take him out with 12 missiles. Yay, we're done.
Yeah, you're right. See, I knew your Godzilla background would come in handy on this one.
Well, it's monsters. It's monsters.
Yeah, it's a significant point. You know, you're right. I think it's interesting that they sort of flip it on its ear at the end, because it's easy for you to say, silly, stupid people, he's not a god, he's just a fish man.
Hmm.
You know, Aquabro. He's... But by the end, there is something so much more mystical about him rather than just an object of or someone whose ability to love. And again, I think that shapes the I think that's significant in the shaping of people's views of the world and of them, because you see, I'm not pronouncing his name right, so I'm just going to say Richard Jenkins's character almost becomes a convert along the way of him in this godlike role, because once he is healed, it's almost this miraculous touch, and he's like, I'll do anything for this thing. It was one thing before he did it for Sally Hawkins, he did it for Eliza. You know, if this is what you want, I'll do it for you. But in that moment, it's about, I'm doing it for him.
Right.
And it gradually becomes more about, let's do it for him. And the scene where Michael Shannon is... Or that climactic scene where Michael Shannon kills him. I'm not gonna call him a Christ figure, but he does resurrect and brings her back to life. Mm-hmm. You know, it is an interesting moment. And Shannon's character Strickland, that revelation that he is a god, almost is like, oh crap, my whole way of viewing the world has been wrong in that moment. And you know that for him, it probably extends beyond that, because everything about Strickland's way of viewing the world has been wrong.
Right.
Up to this point. Like, my gosh, there is something more powerful, something that is beautiful, and it's not the way I like to view the world. I like the world to be the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked about him being the future before. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I was thinking about how when the fish man kills the cat, Richard Jenkins writes him off saying, well, it's not his fault, he's just an animal.
Yeah.
Mm.
But then there's that moment of healing,
Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that movie.
Yeah, and so that does shift things for him, yeah.
I didn't realize they had two cats.
I think they had more than two.
I think they had three.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't play with the cats.
Now he won't.
Also, when the fish man like shuffles away from the cats, it's a classic Dr. Zoidberg move from Futurama. Yeah.
So many things you can do in this movie, I'm telling you. Now it's Futurama. Please come back on the air, Futurama, because you need, just for this, do a Shape of Water episode. Zoidberg and Amy. No. Oh, man. Yeah, you know, the more I talk about the film, the more I like the film. But I can't say it's the most likable film I've seen all year.
Right.
In a lot of ways. I know some people are saying it's the best movie they've ever seen. I think that's saying a lot. But it there's somehow a film that takes place 50 years ago feels so relevant today and is really beautiful. Really beautiful story. Guys, this has been a great conversation, and I really appreciate you both being here. But we should do Screen It or Skip It. Shape of Water, Screen It or Skip It?
Oh, I'd say screen it. Just for the teal.
just for the sheer teal atmosphere. If you don't have enough teal in your life. This is why I like having you on. Criterion Collection, please be listening, because this is a film you need just for the teal.
Just for the teal.
No, I really like that. I'd say screen it for sure.
Yeah, I would. I wasn't sure. Oh, sorry. Do you want to say more?
No, that's okay. All I got.
That's all you got. When I first came out of it, I wasn't sure. The more I thought about it and sort of reflected on it, I would say yes. I think that you have to know what you're getting into. And it is graphic, sexually graphic in a number of places. So if that's an issue, you should take that into consideration. If you don't, if that's not an issue for you, there's something mystical about this film. And that I think really resonates with multiple people, with many people. Hence the applause. And I think, as we've learned, the monster is in all of us. I told you I'd get it in at the end.
That is oddly appropriate for this film.
It is.
It's true.
And you've been mocking it all these years.
I have been. Guys, thank you so much. I love having you on. This was a great conversation. Andrew, I'm sad that there was no Taylor Swift reference for you.
I couldn't find one. In this movie. I couldn't find any. Where's the Tay-Tay in that?
She wears short skirts. He's in the bleachers. Or he wears t-shirts, you know.
Yeah.
And they're in the bathtub. Not the bleachers this time.
Right, that's true.
I do that for you.
Okay, thank you.
That's my Christmas gift to you,
thank you.
Andrew.
Thank you,
Steve. Is that. Yeah. But thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. For those of you at home, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Podomatic, and, of course, on screenfish.net. And if you go to the podcast page on screenfish.net, you can download Fishing for More, which is so appropriate for this film. Oh, my gosh. I just thought of that now. You can be fishing for more with this particular film, which is some small group questions or questions that you can have talking about the film with the people that you want to see it with. And so you feel free to do that as well. And also, Screenfish is now in Canada nonprofit. You can actually donate to us, help us keep our costs, you know, not in the red, but you can donate to Screenfish if you like what we're doing here at, well, I will have the link on the podcast page because I cannot think of it offhand, but it is, and it's available through the website. You can donate to us, and if you're in Canada, it is tax receivable. We will be back next week with our special Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi podcast that will be out before Christmas. We're excited about that one as well. And we have some great stuff coming in the new year. So from us, Merry Christmas as well. Guys, once again, thank you so much. And as always, we started the conversation. This was Screamfish.